Okay, so let's kind of frame the book to begin with. So this is really a very personal, very autobiographical book in a lot of ways. And you describe the process in the book of coming to terms with a shift in your way of thinking about food. But perhaps you could sum it up for the folks who are listening. So tell us briefly about the person that you were, let's say, 20 years ago in terms of nutrition, and the person that you are now, and how you got here from there.
Okay. Well, I became a vegan when I was 16 years old, and it was a friend of my sister's who started talking to me about it. And at that point, the whole low-fat, high-carb sort of a nutritional juggernaut that this culture has been on was really coming to the fore, and I was hearing the sort of same information in health class at school, that eating any kind of animal fat, you know, would essentially kill you, that it would lead to heart disease and it would lead to clogged arteries and, you know, all these terrible things would happen if you were eating any kind of animal fat at all, any kind of saturated fat. And my family history is not good on this. I mean, there's a lot of diabetes and a lot of heart disease. And even at age 16, I was already very concerned about, nutrition and the health. What would good health look like for me, and what did the future hold? There's a lot of alcoholism in my family as well, and I had already decided at a very young age that I was never going to drink, and I stuck to that my whole life. So hearing all this nutritional information was sort of similar, where I thought, well, I better get on this now because I don't want to end up like my great aunt Marge, and I don't want to end up like, you know, these other people in my family who have had these terrible, you know, chronic health conditions. So when I heard about being a vegan, this also segued really nicely into my lifelong passion for justice and for trying to live sustainably and for trying to care about the earth. And these were things that were really important to me even as a very young child. So all of that came together, hearing the kind of vegan worldview that we didn't need to exploit animals, that it was destructive to the earth to do any kind of, to eat any kind of animal products, that raising animals was destructive to the planet, that it was certainly, you know, not a compassionate way to live, to kill animals. And on top of all that, these were the foods that were going to destroy your health long term. So it all came together in this neat little package, and I thought, this is what I'm going to do. So I was a pretty fanatic teenager. When you're that age, things tend to be black and white anyway, and that sort of moral thinking. Also the gift of that age is that, you know, incredible moral vigor. So I took to this like, you know, a house on fire, and that was it. 2 weeks later, I had taken all animal products out of my diet. My mother cried herself to sleep every night because she thought I was going to die. And I was convinced, though, that this was the thing to do. So in that sort of true believer way, I took this on. And I proceeded to destroy my health for 20 years. I ended up doing exactly the thing that I thought I was stopping, which was I really did damage to my body. So I spent 20 years eating no animal protein, no animal fat, eating a very high carbohydrate diet. The only fats I ever ate were almost entirely polyunsaturates with a little bit of monounsaturates here and there. But this is not the diet that human beings were designed for. And I have found that out it's too late at this point. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book was because I would like to stop a lot of other very engaged and politically aware young people from doing this to themselves, because past a certain point, the damage is permanent. And everybody my age who did this long term, because most of my friends tried it, and those of us who really stuck to it, we all ended up with some kind of damage. This is not the diet that the human body was designed for. And I had to face that. Not an easy process, because once you've embraced being a vegetarian or a vegan, generally speaking, it's your identity. It becomes a profound way that you organize your sense of self. So this is one reason why it can be very hard to talk to people who are vegetarians or vegans, is because it's not just new information. You're threatening their sense of self. And I know what that process is like. It's not easy, having been through it myself. But, you know, in the end, it was a journey that I had to make, because my health had just collapsed, so I didn't really have a choice about it. I just needed somebody in the position of authority to sort of guide me through it, and that was the Qigong healer that you mentioned at the beginning. He was a very, very wise, compassionate, just really sweet-natured man, and when he said to me, just as kindly as you can imagine, that, you know, you can't keep doing this, I knew he was right. I really come to the end. But for me, it took somebody in that kind of position to say it. I don't know what I would have done if I had found my book, 10 years ago. I don't know that I would have been able to hear it from a book.
Mm-hmm.
I might have needed an actual person, who I respected and trusted to say this to me. But, on the other hand, I'm always somebody who, I want the full picture. I always want all the information, even if it's something that's painful. I want the truth. And in some ways, my life has really been about a quest for the deepest truth that I can find. So in that regard, I might have picked up the book and looked at it. I might have thought, well, if there's something here I don't know, it's time to learn that. And, if there's a confusing few months here, that's life. I've just got to learn to deal. So I might have picked it up, but I also might have just been so freaked out at the idea that veganism was not, the truth, the light, the way, that I might have just rejected it out of hand. And I certainly know there are people who are treating my book like that. But I will say that I get a lot of fan mail, and I would say 80% of it is from people who were vegans or vegetarians, sometimes quite recently were still vegans. Many of them read my book and saw themselves reflected and knew that indeed it was hurting them to eat this way, and they have now taken the plunge to try something better. And they write back to me and say, wow, I've been eating, or meat or, dairy product now for 2 weeks or a month, and my life has just been transformed. Thank you for giving me my health back. And there were some really, really just moving personal stories in some of these emails. And I would say that's 80% of the emails that I get. Other people have already moved on from being vegetarian or vegan, but almost always it's because their health was suffering from it. And it's been 5 years, 10 years, and they write me these letters and they say, thank you so much for being so clear about why this doesn't work. And thank you so much for explaining that I'm still the same person I was. I still care about all these issues. And you've explained it in such a deeper way that, those core values are still there for me. But I had to look at a bigger picture to see that, in fact, being a vegetarian wasn't the best way to enact my values in the world. And that it's not a way to save the planet, and it's not actually saving animals. It's certainly factory farming is something that we all need to confront and dismantle in every way. That's just a horror, ethically, morally, spiritually, environmentally. But that is not the only way to raise meat, and that this plant-based diet is, in fact, incredibly destructive to the planet. And I think that's a huge thing, that issue right there is something that the environmental movement does not understand and has not looked at. And that is the other reason that I wrote this book, was because I really wanted to get back on track with what would be a real political action to save the planet, because it's not eating a plant-based diet. So I guess those are the emails that I get, is really from people who are either recently or more longer term have given up being a vegetarian or a vegan, and usually it's for health reasons. I think that's the thing that really is able to get through to people first, is if they are suffering from this diet, they want to know how they can get out of it still alive. And in some ways, my book has been a lifeline to them, because having been in that world, I can address exactly, I know the reasons that they took it up, and I can explain why the information they've been given is not correct. So I think it's a relief for a lot of them when they're out of suffering. I think it's a big relief to know that they don't have to keep doing it. I would say the two main things that people end up with are severe blood sugar problems, so hypoglycemia into diabetes. It's hell. I mean, when you're eating nothing but carbohydrate all day, every 2 hours you got to put food in your mouth, and then every hour you got to put food in your mouth, and then no matter how often you eat, you just feel sick all the time, because you're just on this blood sugar roller coaster constantly. And by the end of my vegan days, it was just hell. And it sort of sneaks up on you slowly. It's not like the first time you eat that meal you feel sick, but yes, after 5, 10, 15 years, your insulin receptors they're toast. And so all day long, it's just this constant, the roller coaster of the high, the too low, the too high, the too low. And you just, the adrenaline rush, it's horrible. You're never calm. You're always about to start crying. You always need to have food near you somewhere. And you think that's normal because you get used to it. So I think that's the number one problem, is the blood sugar. I would say the number two problem is this sort of collection of depression, anxiety, these kind of mental health issues that people get. And that is for two reasons. One is that if you don't have enough good quality protein in your diet, your brain cannot make things like serotonin. Serotonin is, for instance, made from tryptophan, which is an amino acid. It's found in protein. There are no good plant sources of tryptophan. I mean, there really aren't any good plant sources of protein anyway. plant proteins come wrapped in cellulose, and the human body cannot digest cellulose. So we can't really access what is in plants. Now add to that the fact that most of the plants that we, you know, that we can eat as humans don't really contain any protein. So you've got this problem if you're, especially if you're a vegan, you're just not getting the amino acids that your brain needs to create a healthy, stable, happy mood. So there's this just tremendous, well of depression among environmentalists and on the left in general, specifically because of the poor diet that we're eating. And, that, I'd say that would be probably, of the people who write to me, that blood sugar is number one, but the depression is absolutely number two. And so I get these really, just profoundly personal emails where people are saying, my God, you gave me my life back. You know, I've spent 2 years, you know, unable to get out of bed. I was so depressed. I didn't know what was wrong. I've tried all these medications. And I realized it started, you know, 6 months after becoming a vegetarian when I read your book. And I've been eating meat for 3 weeks, and I am a completely different person. And I'm happy to get up in the morning, and I can function again. And my friends don't even believe me. You know, it's like, it's so profound. So I'm getting a lot of those emails as well. So the anxiety, depression, a few of these people, it's so extreme that they were borderline psychotic. And eating meat was all it took to make them be able to reclaim their mental health again. And those emails are just, I mean, they just made me cry when I read them because, I mean, they say, you saved my life. So I think that there's a huge misunderstanding among people who take up a vegetarian diet of what our brains need. And then the other part is not just the protein, but the fat. I mean, the human brain is almost 70% saturated fat. It doesn't matter how many, amino acids you eat. If you don't have some fat to go with it, your neurotransmitters can't actually fire. I mean, all of that depends on a steady supply of saturated fat into your brain. So both of those things are really necessary for us to function as, you know, stable, calm, happy people. And without them, it's, you know, you're hanging on by your fingernails every day. And that was certainly something that I suffered as well. And I didn't understand it, you know. It's just, everything was horrible. Like the least tiny thing would send me over the edge. You know, I'd lose my wallet. I didn't know where my wallet was in the house. And I would sit on the floor and just cry. Like I couldn't get up. And like, you shouldn't be knocked over because you can't find your wallet, you know. Like you should have a little more emotional resilience. You can cry on the floor when your mother dies, you know. Like losing your wallet should not be, you know, the incident that destroys you for a week. But that's what life was like. So I would say those are the two main things. There's, you know, plenty of subsidiary things. In my case, my joints also went, and I have a degenerative disease of my spine now, which is never going to go away. I mean, I'm going to be living the rest of my life in chronic pain. So a lot of people end up with joint problems as well from that. Teeth, a lot of people end up with teeth problems. You know, you get all these cavities at age 25, and the dentist is like, what is wrong with your teeth? The nice part about the teeth thing is that a lot of people find that their teeth will remineralize. So if you're eating good bone broth every day, you can make your own broth from scratch, and lots of raw animal fats, your teeth can actually rebuild, and you'll get new enamel in your teeth. People have cavities that have sealed over so that the actual decay has stopped, and that's an incredible process to witness, even at, you know, on the sidelines, that the human body can repair in so many amazing ways. So those are things that have happened to people as well from doing these diets long term. The soy, of course, adds a whole other level. Soy is really not edible for human beings. And I lived on soy, so I had a lot of problems from that, too. But in my case, I was lucky because when I took the soy out of my diet, all of those problems went away almost instantaneously. You know, to get sort of personal, I basically didn't menstruate the entire time I was a vegan. And I took the soy out of my diet, and 3 weeks later, I got my period and have not missed one since. So it really could not have been more dramatic in my case.
Wow.
I have another family member who also was a long-term vegan, ate tons of soy, and she ended up with endometriosis very, very clearly from the soy because she can track it, you know, in her life history, when she was eating soy, when the endometriosis got bad. She lived in Europe for a while where they don't really have soy products. The endometriosis went away completely and nobody knew why. Well, it was the soy. She came back to America, started eating soy, it came back twice as bad, and eventually she had to have a hysterectomy from that. So her case was not as easily solved. And in the end, there were, you know, some pretty serious consequences from that. But I've had a fair number of emails, too, from people who have suffered from soy and didn't realize that's what it was. Take the soy out of their diets. A lot of intestinal complaints, and some of them quite serious. You know, it's just constant stomach ache, the vomiting. really bad intestinal cramping. They go to the doctor. They swallow the radioactive barium. Nobody can figure out what's going on. Like, yeah, try the soy. You know, I hear they're a vegetarian. It's like, it's the soy. Take the soy milk out. And 2 weeks later, they're like, wow, you cured it. But, you know, it's not edible. There's trypsin inhibitors in soy. And trypsin is a digestive enzyme that we need to digest our food. And soy stops your pancreas from being able to produce that. So then you can't digest your food. So, yeah, you're going to end up with cramping. You're going to end up with all these problems. The phytoestrogens are just really disruptive to our whole hormonal system. So it doesn't surprise me that I ended up with these problems and that my, you know, friends and colleagues ended up with some of their problems from the soy. And that's really direct. And some of it's really scary. You know, the birth defects, the precocious puberty, a lot of this goes back to soy. And it's depressing to me because people on the left are the ones who are supposed to care about this kind of stuff. And I think that this sort of vegetarian worldview is blinding us to what is happening to children in inner city schools from eating soy products. Like right now, precocious puberty is almost 50% in African American girls. And it's because of the soy products that's in their diet from the free school lunches and especially from the infant formula. And this is an issue that we really need to get militant about because they are destroying children's lives with this. And, you know, because we've accepted that soy is, you know, what's going to bring the peaceable kingdom to the world, we're not looking at what's really going on here. And there's very, very few people who are taking this up as an issue. And I think that's really the reason is that the people who are supposed to care about it can't look at it, you know, from a perspective that would give us the truth about it because we've embraced soy as, you know, one of this great environmental, you know, nonviolent way to eat. And we're just wrong about it. It's just we don't have the full evidence before us. And I really see this as a problem, and I'm just hoping that, you know, more and more people actually have trouble digesting it, and as the word spreads that soy isn't necessarily a good thing for humans, that more people will get on board with that. Sally Fallon and the people at the Western Price Foundation have done a lot of political organizing about soy and trying to keep soy out of children's diets, but they're really the only people. Everybody else thinks that soy is great. And we've really been, it's a snow job that the soy industry has done on us because 30 years ago, everybody knew that soy was junk and that it was, you know, poor people's food that was, you know, it was a joke that they would put soy into, you know, hamburgers and stuff and who in their right mind would eat this? It's like the new soy went green essentially. But, you know, they did this huge marketing campaign in the late 70s and early 80s to sell it as, you know, a high income, food for, you know, rich people who did yoga and, you know, went to workshops and stuff. So it got sold as sort of a cultural accoutrement to a certain lifestyle. And they were very successful. So now if, you know, you're sort of a lefty progressive person, you drink soy milk. But that had to be sold to us. I mean, it was packaged and sold so that we would accept it in our diets. And it's been a huge mistake. I mean, these are industrial waste products, people. They're not actually, you know, meant for human beings.
In order to write this book, you really had to draw evidence from a variety of domains. And so we've touched on, you know, a bit of medical evidence, a bit of nutritional evidence, a bit of environmental evidence. And, I mean, you really had to collect quite a lot of clinical evidence as well as scientific thinking into your book. And so now, obviously, you know, you present it as almost a compendium of scientific evidence as well as experience that led you in this general direction. But do you think you could identify maybe one or two little factoids or items that for you really made it click, like really gave you the aha moment? I mean, perhaps soy was one of them, but are there others that really just made you go, oh, wow, knowing this has just cracked my universe?
Yeah, Malcolm Kendricks is a doctor, he's in England, or maybe he's in Scotland, one or the other, and he has this great book that's called The Great Cholesterol Con, which walks you through all the evidence about cholesterol, that there is no link between dietary cholesterol and heart disease, there is no link between even dietary cholesterol and blood cholesterol in people, and he had a great YouTube video where he takes all this information from the World Health Organization. They did a study that was called MONICA. That's the acronym for it, but it was the Monitoring Trends in Cardiovascular Health. This was the biggest study ever done in the world about cholesterol. And so they compiled all this data from like 40 different countries about levels of dietary cholesterol intake and then what is the heart disease rate for these people. And there is literally no connection. So in under a minute and a half, you know, like in about 90 seconds, Malcolm Kendricks shows you this graph, and here are the Aboriginal Australian Aborigines who have the highest heart disease rate in the world, yet their dietary intake of cholesterol is like less than 20 times that of France or Greece. And then you can go to the other end of the graph and you see countries that have really high cholesterol levels and yet almost no heart disease. And so there it is in black and white. Like, it's just, there is no connection. And all those years, you know, that was what got me into this on a dietary level, was hearing that in my health class in, you know, 10th grade, that, oh my God, if you eat saturated fat, you're going to die of a heart attack. Looking at my familial history, seeing that people were, had a tendency to these diseases, and thinking, oh my God, I've got to get this out of my diet. And, you know, 20 years later, I see this graph, and it was all crap. It was made up information. You know, and all the reasons that, you know, we can talk about big pharma and, you know, the Lipitor and all the statin drugs. And yes, there are huge industries behind this. They want us to believe these myths because they will make money. And I know that sounds like a conspiracy theory, but I don't think there's like 10 people doing this, but, you know, it is how capitalism works, and it is how things are set up in the United States. And, you know, we need to question the powers that be. They do not have our best interests at heart. What they have, you know, their reason for existing is to make money for their stockholders, and they'll do what it takes to do that. I mean, we set up a like a sociopathic system, essentially, where this really bad behavior gets rewarded by money. So it's not really about our health. It is about a whole bunch of other very moneyed interests. But, you know, seeing graphs like that where it makes it so obvious that this has nothing to do with what makes people healthy. So Malcolm Kendricks certainly, you know, was a big moment for me. Reading the soy information also were big moments for me because, you know, I'd already been living in pain for many, many years with my spine, and seeing that, you know, soy had this terrible impact on cartilage in people. You know, and people's joints, I realized what I had done to myself. And I would say the third moment was actually reading Weston Price's book, which is called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. Now, this is not a book that's meant for, you know, a wide public audience. It's kind of boring. It's long. It was written in, you know, I think the early 40s or the late 30s. But it is a book well worth at least flipping through for the photographs. And it was the photographs that got me. Because what he did was he found a bunch of people all over the world, Europe, Asia, Africa. He went to every continent, and he found people, even at that point in the 1930s, you could still find groups of people who were not eating industrial food. A lot of them were still hunter-gatherers. They were fishing people. And he wanted to find people who achieved perfect health in generation after generation. And he had a, you know, pretty tightly defined version of what that would mean. No chronic diseases, perfect dentition, easy childbirth, no mental illnesses, and that they could achieve this, you know, sort of long-term over many generations. So he went and he visited some of these people, and it was a great moment to do this because not only were there still some people who hadn't been influenced by either, you know, imperialism or modern foods of some kind, the camera was actually a portable instrument at that point. So it meant that he could take photographs. So you see the pictures of these people, and you've got the parents who have the most beautiful teeth and bones you've ever seen in your life, just perfect, perfect, you know, row of pearls teeth, they call them, where you've just never seen such gorgeous smiles. And then the children. So you've got the next generation. Modern foods have been introduced. They're eating nothing but white flour and white sugar and vegetable oil, and the kids are a mess. Their teeth don't fit. Their noses are too narrow. You can see that the template has been broken. And so seeing picture after picture, that this is what happens to human beings when they're not eating the foods that we were meant for, that was a profound moment for me, because I'm looking at these pictures going, wow, those people don't have degenerating spines, and I do. And that's what they ate, and this is what I ate, and it was so clear what had happened to me. So I would say, you know, the Weston Price stuff was, those people saved my life. I mean, that was amazing. That was an incredible moment. And I would say, even if you don't want to read the book, just look at the photographs. You've got to be convinced that, you know, there is a human template, and we are meant to eat really nutrient-dense foods. And by eating, you know, this kind of high-carb, low-fat diet, we're doing exactly the opposite. And you will see what you've done to yourself. You know, if you've been doing this long-term, you know what I'm talking about. And the evidence is right there in the pictures. So I would say those are three good moments for me, mm-hmm. Malcolm Kendricks, soy, and Weston Price.
Mm-hmm. So now, I mean, let's touch briefly on ethical issues, because I think that many people really do think about ethical concerns when they eat, and I think that it's become an issue that people increasingly if not their, if, you know, if it's not a preoccupation, they certainly, you know, it certainly whisks through their brain briefly as they right. try to make their choices in the grocery store. And clearly we know that many people get into eating vegetarian or vegan because of concern over animal welfare. And certainly I'm sure you've received your share of mail claiming that, you know, you hate animals now. But, right. I mean, how right. do you deal with the accusation that because you consume meat, your concern for animals has diminished? And maybe tell me about how you see these two things to be compatible. How do you reconcile eating meat and yet caring for animals?
Right. So this is one of these moments where I can't do it in a soundbite, which is why I end up writing. I blew up for this reason, because it's not something that I can do in 30 seconds.
Sure.
From the outside, it seems obvious that, you know, oh my God, you kill animals. This is terrible. Whereas I don't eat animals, therefore I like animals more than you. Well, you know, you could look at that without knowing any more about it and think, well, sure, killing animals is wrong and not killing animals would be a more ethical decision. The problem is that we don't understand the nature of agriculture, because agriculture is the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet. So eating an agricultural diet is not, in fact, saving animals. This is what agriculture is. You take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. By doing this, it means that the animals have nowhere to go. And this is what we've done on continent after continent. So first of all, it means that all of those creatures, the plants, the animals, everything that makes topsoil possible, they have been eradicated. Now you plant it with these annual monocrops, which is, you know, supposedly what we're all supposed to be eating. Well, what happens is you're drawing down the soil, because the basic template of the earth is what I call perennial polyculture. So it's basically forest, grasslands, wetland, savanna. You've got plants that live a very long time all together in a community. Their basic job is to protect and build topsoil. And that's why the earth makes forests and savannas and, you know, prairies and wetlands. And topsoil is the basis of life itself. So you've got all these creatures working together, forming these resilient communities that are essentially about building topsoil. Agriculture is the exact opposite, because you clear away those plants, whether it's prairie or whether it's forest, you clear them away, and then you just plant these annuals, which only live for a season or two, and it means that every time you do that, not only have you destroyed the forest and the prairies, but every time you plant those crops, you're destroying more topsoil. At this point, the planet has literally been skinned alive. There is no topsoil left. By 1950, in fact, there should have been mass starvation everywhere. What happened instead was the Green Revolution. So what we've been eating since 1950 is, in fact, fossil fuel. We've been eating nitrogen fertilizer that's made from gas and oil. That's put off the inevitable, you know, for a few generations. Eventually, we're going to be faced with the same problem. But my ultimate goal here is that we need to be repairing the template of the earth, which means we need to take all the agricultural land and put it back into forest and back into prairie and restore the wetlands. That is the only thing that's going to save this planet. Once that's done, as humans, our role is to take our place from inside those communities and get our food from inside those living, vibrant communities that are what make life possible. So we need to understand that agriculture is what destroys forests and prairies. By its nature, that's what it does. And on a grimmer level, it destroys the actual topsoil, which is the basis of life itself. And once we've restored those perennial polycultures, the forests and the prairies and whatnot, to take our place inside them means that we, like every other living creature, we need to get our sustenance as members of those communities. Now, as humans, we cannot digest cellulose. We can't eat grass. Buffalo can eat grass. Zebra can eat grass. We cannot. We do not have the mechanism to digest cellulose. I mean, a cow has a rumen. She has this incredible vat, this fermentative vat inside her. And what's actually happening in there is that she eats the grass. She's feeding that grass to bacteria that live inside her. And then after the bacteria eat the grass, she eats the bacteria. So it's a circle where each of these creatures is doing something for the other. You know, she's feeding the bacteria and then she eats them. And then, you know, she's also part of this cycle that is the grasslands, where the grass actually needs her inputs as well. The grass needs to be grazed by these animals. It actually, if you take a grassland and you take the ruminants off it, you will end up with a desert, because they have really important functions to play. So all of us are members of this community, and we need to play our role. Like I said, if you take the cow off the grass, you'll end up with a desert. But in the same way, if you don't have predators on the cows, it will also turn into a desert because the cows will overpopulate and they will degrade it until there's nothing left. And that is our role as humans. I mean, we are predators. So our role is to eat the cows. And the cow eats the grass, the bacteria, you know, plays the role. Then we eat the cows. And then in the end, the soil eats us all because we all die one way or another. And then the nutrients are taken up again into the soil and into the grass. We are part of a cycle. We are part of a living community. That is the only way for humans to live sustainably, is to be part of that. And it does involve death. The problem is that there is no death-free option. You can pretend that your fluffy soybean whatever is some kind of death-free option, but it is not. In the getting of those soybeans, an entire continent has been cleared of all life. And all of those animals were killed. There are no longer, you know, free-roaming buffalo, so that we could grow soybeans and wheat and corn. And the degradation continues. And if we don't stop it soon, there will be nothing left. There's no more water left. You know, all the rivers have been drained. The ancient aquifers have been pumped dry. At this point, they're using oil drilling equipment to get that water out. And we've got global warming. Now, the only good news here is that if we took all the agricultural land basically east of the Mississippi, and we put it back into prairie, back into grassland, the United States would immediately become a carbon sink. And that's still with everybody driving SUVs. So we could, in fact, stop global warming. We could stop it on a dime if we understood what the problem was. If the entire planet would do that, if we would take all the agricultural land and put it back into prairie and forest now, it would only take 9 or 10 years to take all the carbon that we've added since the industrial age. All of that could be withdrawn from the atmosphere in under 10 years if we would simply repair what we have destroyed and then take our place again inside those living communities. So, you know, one way to say this is that we've really got two choices. We can be the part of the death that's destroying all life, or we can be part of the death that's the cycle of life. But those are our only options. You know, we can dominate or we can participate, but in the end, there's no way out. There is no death-free option. And I understand where the vegetarians, there's this tremendous longing to live a compassionate and nonviolent life. And those are values that have motivated me forever. I mean, since I was 4 years old. But they don't have the information to make the right, decision about this. And so my goal in writing this book was to provide that information so that we could make better decisions, both as individuals, but also as a movement, because our planet is in serious distress. And we need to understand the actions that need to be taken at this point before it's too late.
I'm imagining people listening to this thinking, okay, well, what the heck am I supposed to do, right? And I think that we all have different levels of engagement, right? Like some people are in a very new stage of coming to awareness. They're dimly aware that, you know, a styrofoam pack of chicken actually comes from anything else other than,
right,
you know, a machine. Where, you know, and other people are much more conscious. But so, I mean, imagine we have a person who says, okay, you know, how do I become a more ethically, sensitive eater? What kinds of steps should I take, or what kinds of things should I be thinking about? If you're going to offer advice, perhaps, to these people, you know, what kinds of concrete things might you say?
I think the most important thing is to eat meat that is grass-fed. So what this means is you're unlikely to find this at a store. It means that you need to make a personal connection with a farmer. And that is also a really good thing to do, because I strongly believe we need to have personal connections to our food, to the people who are growing it, to the land where it's grown, and to the animals themselves. So you got to find somebody in your area who is doing grass-fed, grass-based farming, grass-fed meat. And there are some really great websites. So, for instance, Jill Robinson's site is called eatwild.com. And she has a state-by-state listing of all the grass-based farmers in every state. And it's really great because it's easy to find. So find one of those farmers. Go look at her website, and you will find, you know, there's beef, there's lamb, there's goat, there's buffalo, there's all kinds of good stuff. A lot of these farms also understand that for the ruminants to be healthy, for the grass to be healthy, you have to have more than one species, because that's how nature works. So after the ruminants go through, the pasture is then filled with birds, which is nature's model. So they'll also have pasture-raised chickens, or goose, or duck, or guinea fowl. And there's all kinds of, you know, interesting things you can try. But these are integrated communities that they are building, living communities. And So to eat that kind of food, it means that the animals have a great life. They're having the lives they want to have. They're out on grass all day with their heads in the green, just eating the way a cow should. And so the animals are extremely healthy. The land is being, the topsoil is being built. The land is being protected because it's in permanent cover. You could come back 10,000 years from now, and the only difference would be a few more inches of topsoil, and that is what we need to see on this planet. So every time you buy meat from a local grass-based farmer, you are doing something very direct to help save the planet. You cannot say the same thing for wheat or soy or corn. You can say that about grass-based farming. So find those farmers in your area. Pay them whatever they need to pay to be paid to make a living, because they work hard. It's hard work. Another thing you can do, if you even have a suburban plot, is get chickens. Get your own backyard chickens. It's the most amazing experience you'll ever have. Chickens are so much fun. And so you can have wonderful little friends, as well as having fresh eggs every single day. And if you've got kids, oh my God, they're going to have the time of their lives. You can also get really involved on a local level with this, because in a lot of places it's illegal to have urban chickens. And you can get involved and try to re-legalize that. I mean, that, none of that was done until the 40s and the 50s. It used to be fine to keep livestock in your small yard. People used to have goats in cities. They used to have chickens and geese in their backyards. So get involved on a local level and make food more reliable and more ethical. Grow it yourself. The closer it is to home, the less fossil fuels involved in getting it to you. And as things get scarier and scarier with peak oil and economic collapse, we're going to need to remember how to grow our own food. So this is a great project on every level, because you're helping to build a more resilient community where you live. You're helping to build topsoil. You're learning skills you're going to need. You'll make friends with your neighbors. You can get involved in local politics by trying to make everybody understand why this is important. Maybe you need to change a city ordinance to have chickens. You'll learn about direct democracy that way. There's nothing wrong with this project. It's only good across the board. Plus, you'll get these cute little critters running around. I always say people need, everybody needs to have their own personal dinosaurs. They're just so much fun, chickens. I mean, they just do the most, you'll just have stories forever. You're going to be like those people with the, you know, the photographs of their two-year-olds. You know, it's like I got pictures of chickens in my wallet. It's like, oh, look what she did today. But they're really fun. So, and they're a great animal to start with, because their needs are very simple. So I would say, yeah, get a grass-based farmer in your area, buy your food from them, and think about having some backyard animals yourself to help with food production. And get involved with all that stuff, because it's great, and we're going to need to know how to do that as the future, you know, gets sort of tighter and scarier. I almost always start my day with chicken broth, and I make my own, which means I collect bones. And if I don't have enough, I collect chicken bones from other people. Like I say to anybody, if you eat chicken, just throw it in the freezer when you're done, and I will come and get it. And sometimes I have to order bones from, you can get like chicken parts really cheap in a great big box from the regular grocery store. And sometimes I don't want to do that, because I know that that stuff is factory farmed, and I'm not happy about that. But I also tell myself, well, this is the stuff that's going to get turned into dog food anyway, because it's the stuff nobody wants. It's like the necks and the backs. So if I'm really desperate, I'll get that. If not, you know, if I can get pasture-raised chicken and I've got lots of bones lying around, that's what I make my broth with. So the process of making broth is a traditional skill that we have more or less lost over the last 50 to 100 years. People, you know, around the world eat broth, and it's just an amazingly healing substance. So it's really simple. You just throw the bones in a huge stock pot, and you boil it for about 24 hours. Just keep it simmering. And at the very end, I throw in some, I don't know, corn and onions, and not corn, carrots and onions and celery, and maybe some herbs to make it, you know, more savory. But even if you don't do that, it's still really great, because it's minerals and it's gelatin, and both of those things are just so great for so many human biological processes. Now, I mean, the broth for me is especially important, because I do have this spinal condition, but it's good for everybody, especially if you're a young child or if you're thinking about getting pregnant. You cannot have too many minerals in your body. So broth is really important. So I'll put some broth in a pot, and I boil it, and then I add 2 eggs, my pasture-raised eggs, and I make egg drop soup. And that is what I have almost every single morning for breakfast. So then for lunch, I will usually have beef. I have a freezer is really important if you're going to eat well, because the best way to get grass-fed products is in bulk from the farm. It's really hard to just buy it, you know, a pound or two as you need it. So if you can get a really big freezer, you'll be in a lot better shape for all of this. So I usually have a freezer that's filled with grass-fed beef, grass-fed pork, sometimes chicken, and sometimes if I can get really good fish that is wild-caught and sustainable, I will have that in the freezer as well. So lunch is usually beef of some sort, and I got to say that I am absolutely a fanatic for barbecue sauce. So I usually have burgers with barbecue sauce, and I could eat that every day and be really happy. And usually for lunch, it will be vegetable matter of some sort, depending on what is fresh and seasonal at the moment. So like today I've got, I know I'll be having salad with my beef barbecue, which will also include zucchini. So, and then dinner for me is usually not very big, but that's just because I have stomach problems, but I can't usually eat a big meal in the evening. But it'll usually be more the same, so I'll have another piece of meat, usually some fish maybe, depending, or maybe a chicken breast or something, and then whatever other vegetables look good. I might eat a piece of fruit at that point if I have some good apples or pears or something. I don't tend to eat tropical fruit. I don't really like it, but I also know that the cost of the planet is just a little too high, so tropical fruit tends to be a treat for me. I don't eat it very much anyway. It's just not something I crave. I think if I craved oranges, I'd be in a bad way. I'd have to feel guilty about it, but luckily I don't, so it's not that big a deal. So that's pretty much what I eat on a regular basis. I have nuts, too, that I eat sometimes sort of as a snack. I also have really good raw cheeses that are from cows that are all pasture-fed. And I mean, those are important things that we can get into this more if you want, but it's really important if you're going to eat dairy that it be raw dairy products, that it not be pasteurized. So again, you have to find farms that are doing it and go to the farm and buy the cheese. And a lot of these are artisanal cheeses and they can be rather pricey, but it's well worth it to get, not factory farmed, tortured cows. And again, building the topsoil with the grass feeding, but you also end up with a product that's nutritionally way more suited to the human body, because the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is perfect. So the fats are in really good shape. And because it's raw, it means that the cheeses themselves are pre-digested by the enzymes, so really easy to assimilate. A lot of people who think that they are lactose intolerant can, in fact, drink raw milk and eat raw milk cheeses because the enzymes are there to help you digest it. And because it's pre-digested, it means that it's way more available, bioavailable to us. So, yeah, I'll have a snack that'll be like, some nuts and some cheese. Or a little yogurt. Sometimes I make my own yogurt, also from raw milk. So that pretty much wraps up my day. If I'm feel like I need a treat, of course my thing is chocolate. nothing good you can really say about chocolate, but I do love dark chocolate, so sometimes I'll have a little bit of that just as a treat. So that is my big vice, chocolate. Chocolate only grows within 11 degrees of the equator. Like, there's no way I can pretend that chocolate is local. and I also know that it is a tree, but it's a sort of a small tree, chocolate. But the chocolate plantations are just as bad as coffee plantations and tea plantations in terms of being essentially a monocrop. So, and there's a lot of slavery involved with all of those tropical products. I know that. So, if you can afford to get the fair trade chocolate, at least it's a little bit better than just what you get at the store. So, hard things that we have to face in terms of food. A lot of issues there. So the only thing I would add is that you have to do a lot of research on your own to figure all this out. We are not being given the correct information. Mm-hmm. We're not being given it from the mass media, from our governments, from the public health institutions in our country. We're definitely not being given it by pharmaceutical companies. So it means digging around a lot to try to figure out what you think the truth is about the proper human diet. And I think the thing that convinced me the most was realizing that for 4 million years we were hunter-gatherers. So clearly that is the diet we were designed for. So my diet now tries to approximate those foods as much as possible. So try to keep it simple, because you're going to be overwhelmed with all this conflicting information. But, come back to your ancestors. 4 million years, there's no way that those 4 million years are a lie, We still have the bodies of Paleolithic people. So a Paleolithic diet is, more or less what's going to fit us now and give us the most vibrant health that we can achieve. But I have total sympathy for people out there trying to figure out what is a good thing to eat and what is not, because we've had so much information thrown at us.